Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Let me know how I sound here. I know it takes a little while for YouTube to catch up. So hello, hello, hello. Good afternoon. Welcome to this live stream on a Monday afternoon. Please do like the stream as you're coming in here. Let me know how I sound. And also, I have the air conditioner on. So if you can hear that, just let me know. I don't really want to turn it off because it's absolutely scorching out today here out in the East Coast of the United States. So please let me know if you hear that, if it's disruptive, if there's kind of like a gray noise in the background. If not, I'm just going to continue because I think it's important to be comfortable while we're doing these things. But in any event, while you're here, like the stream. Please like the stream. Share the stream. Subscribe to the channel. Make sure you're hitting that notifications bell. Make sure that you're following me on Telegram. You can get the notification a lot easier there. I'm going to put it in the chat now. So I'm putting my Telegram in the chat now so you can follow me there. I'm going to be... it's going to be easier to go public with these kind of streams from there. It's really hard to be prioritized on YouTube because there's so much going on with the algorithm and all of that. So please do follow me there on Telegram. I also have a new link tree I'm going to share with all of you later on. I'm trying to get some things together. But while you're here, like the stream, subscribe to the channel, share the stream, hit the notifications bell, and of course, I'm less than $100 a month. I'm about $83 a month from my Patreon goal. So please do subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong, or you can subscribe annually at Substack. All of those links of how to support me are in the description of this video. So I'm very close to my goal. I want to just thank everyone from my loyal followers, subscribers on Patreon, everyone who kind of stuck by me while I was in Twitter jail, quote unquote. You all were amazing, incredible, spreading the word about it. There are a lot of people that also, you know, in the indie media space who also helped do that. Ben Norton, Richard Medhurst, Lee Camp, Katie Halper and Jimmy Dore had me on their programs. It was really great to have people coming out in support of me as I was going through Twitter jail, quote unquote, and now I'm out. So I'm only going to spend about 10 minutes on that segment. Then I'm going to spend a longer period going over what I think really is the conspiracy here, which is the fact that big tech social media corporations like Twitter are partnering with Defense Department funded, military contractor funded, big tech funded think tanks in order to remove accounts like mine. When I came out of Twitter jail, I immediately was given the message that I have full functionality. However, any further violation of Twitter rules will get me removed. So that's why I have my Telegram shared in the chat. That's why I do urge you to follow me there at The Haifong Press. Just look that up on Telegram. It's a public channel. I also have a group where you can participate and chat. And also sometimes I can weigh in. So this is a special episode today. I'm going to go over a few subjects, a few topics, right? About three. I'm going to try to spend 20 to 30 minutes on each one. And then I'm going to try to end this by 2:30, no later than 2:45, and get on the Call-In app. I'll make sure to share that link with all of you and then hopefully have another half hour, 45 minutes, where I'm actually interacting directly with you guys. So please do, if you're not following me on Call-In just yet, please do that. I'm going to share the link now in the chat, and then at the end, I will share it as well. There is the show for later at 2:30 p.m. Eastern. It might be a little later since we are getting a little bit of a late start. I wasn't expecting a food delivery to come. It came, and so, you know, can't let the food spoil. Please do like the stream, like the stream, like the stream, like the stream. Boost the algorithm. Fortunately, I think there are more than a few people on live at this time. I never know when to go on live because it feels like a lot of us share followers, share subscribers, and we all know that YouTube deprioritizes our work in the algorithm. So please do share, like, boost this in the algorithm. Be sure also to consider subscribing to my work at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong or Substack or wherever else. Okay. And all of that can be found in the link in the description. So I want to get to the first story, everyone. Hello. Good afternoon. I want to get to the first story. And that is, it's not really a story. It's something that's been going on for quite a while. This is an ongoing development. And that is Twitter removing accounts that essentially the US government doesn't like. Essentially removing accounts that challenge US foreign policy, US imperialism, that go against the establishment narrative on what the United States is doing against China, against Latin America, Russia. We can go on and on and on, but I want to focus on China. And that's because, I mean, first, I was subject to being locked out for a week for telling the truth about Tiananmen Square. And I'm not going to rehash all of that because I've talked about this in prior streams and also on other people's programs. But I want to talk about something I was thinking about as I was locked out of Twitter. And that is, well, what is the material basis for this? Why is this happening? Is it just Twitter deciding, well, we want to get rid of these accounts? No, it's because the United States is waging a ruthless new Cold War to maintain its hegemony. It's trying to use all of the tools at its disposal, mainly militarily, to try to, quote unquote, contain China. But one of the key elements of this is squashing domestic dissent, is repressing any possibility that an anti-war movement or an anti-imperialist movement will arise from the mounting dangers that are really just continuing to build up, it seems, month after month after month, whether we're talking about the Russia-Ukraine conflict, whether we're talking about Biden saber-rattling about Taiwan. I mean, it just never seems to end. It seems like the dangers of this new Cold War are only becoming more and more acute. So social media has played a role as essentially the private contractor of the surveillance state. And one of the ways it is doing this is by partnering with think tanks that are completely enveloped and enmeshed in the military state in order to remove accounts that the United States doesn't like. And I believe that that is why I was locked out and why I have basically this kind of like three strike law. I was locked out for 12 hours defending Wyatt Reed over Keith Olbermann's slander about his trip to Nicaragua, then this with China. And now it seems like Twitter is saying that if I am reported one more time, quote unquote, then I will be removed. So why is this happening? Well, I want to talk about the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And I also want to talk about what Twitter has been doing over the past few years in removing accounts, especially accounts related to China. I'm first going to pull up a few things before I get into an article by Alan McLeod that I think is very important. Okay, so let me pull up what Twitter has been doing in terms of removing accounts. They actually announced that they're very, I won't say they're transparent about this, but I will say that they talk about this publicly. They're not hiding the fact that they are seeking to remove anyone who's putting out a message that they don't like and painting it as some kind of state-linked information operation. That's how they promote this. So let's see if this is the correct one here. So I'm sharing this. This is the one from 2021. So I actually want to share the one from 2020 first. So it's out of order when I put it on the screen share here. Okay, well, is this the right one? Let's see. Here we go. So in 2020, tens of thousands of accounts, and not just tens of thousands of accounts, we're talking about More than 170,000 accounts were removed. This is just what Twitter wanted to tell you all about. And they use this language that I want to point out is very, I don't want to say Orwellian, because George Orwell was an MI asset. He was a UK intelligence asset. So I'm not a big fan of Mr. Orwell. But I will say that it is very troubling when Twitter will literally tell us to our face that they're collaborating with institutions and organizations that have at their very root a new Cold War orientation and really the motivation to push forward U.S. imperialist foreign policy objectives. So here in June of 2020, when 170,000 accounts were removed that were so-called China-linked, it says that they are disclosing 32,000 of them, right? And it's not just with China. They talk about the People's Republic of China, Russia, and Turkey that these accounts were connected to. But look at who they're working with. We have shared relevant data from this disclosure with two leading research partners, Australian Strategic Policy Institute and the Stanford Internet Observatory, which I'll just briefly comment on, is a program at Stanford that basically just hires former big tech, mainly Facebook conduits, operatives, who then publish material and conduct in operations like this at the behest of big tech to target anyone who is supposedly connected to Russia. It's mainly Russia. It's mainly a Russiagate operation. But the Australian Strategic Policy Institute is mainly a China operation, mainly an anti-China operation. And it's a huge deal, and we're going to get to why. But I want to just point out here really quick. So it talks about 150,000 amplifier accounts and 23,750 accounts that form the core of the network. So this information operation led by China, supposedly. And so they removed all of these accounts. So that's more than 170,000. Okay, so amplifier accounts, basically meaning anyone who talks about China and amplifies these messages that these so-called 20,000 plus accounts were providing on social media. And they're saying that all these accounts are fake or that they were repurposed accounts. But I want to read this. It said, in general, this entire network was involved in a range of manipulative and coordinated activities. They were tweeting predominantly in Chinese languages and spreading geopolitical narratives favorable to the Communist Party of China, while continuing to push deceptive narratives about the political dynamics in Hong Kong. So this is xenophobia, right? I mean, this is how you know the new Cold War against Russia, against China. It's xenophobic. It's Russophobic. It is racist to the core. Just literally saying that Chinese languages were targeted here, that anyone who was speaking in primarily Chinese languages, I'm sure not many in Twitter can really translate, they would take them down. So I just wanted to show you that, to show that Twitter is actually, I won't say call them transparent, but I will say that they are saying that they are working with think tanks and with these institutions to take down accounts that promote geopolitical narratives that are favorable to China, which is just another way of saying geopolitical narratives that are unfavorable to the United States. So basically doing the bidding of the U.S. war machine. And here we go. We have another, a year, you know, not even, you know, I think, what was that, a year and a half later? In December, they talk about more accounts related to the People's Republic of China, Russia, Tanzania, Uganda, Venezuela. So expanding under Biden, seems like everything was expanding in terms of the assault on those of us who are challenging the imperialist narrative. So again, right, Australian Strategic Policy Institute, Cazadores de Fake News, that is an Ivan Duque connected, Colombia connected think tank, which has been, according to Venezuela, according to the ALBA countries, has been at the root of promoting propaganda about quote-unquote human rights violations to justify sanctions, to justify the attempts to overthrow governments like Venezuela's. So Cazadores de Fake News is another kind of AstroTurf organization meant to cause havoc in the region. Here you see more. You see more of the removal of the accounts. This was all about Xinjiang. What was happening in December of 2021? Well, the U.S. establishment was trying to build up the justification for the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, right? So that act actually banned all products imported from Xinjiang if the companies who produced those products and distributed them couldn't prove that they weren't using forced labor. So essentially a massive escalation of sanctions against China, especially its Xinjiang region. And so here you see that they removed a couple of thousand of accounts. And we can go on and on and on. But here you see Venezuela gets into the mix where they're removing basically a network of Venezuelan accounts that amplified hashtags and topics in support of the government and its official narratives. So they're admitting, Twitter is admitting that it is going through your data. It is going through your data and taking down accounts based on the messages that these accounts put out there. So if you are someone like me who talks a lot about China because I am passionate about stopping this imperialist military, economic, political aggression toward China, then you are potentially labeled a state-linked information operation, and you're at risk of being taken down. So I do truly believe that what happened to me on the anniversary of Tiananmen Square is closely related to this effort on the part of Twitter, connecting with think tanks like the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. So now I want to get to the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. I'm going to pull up an article. I'm going to try to read through it relatively quickly because it's a longer article, but it's from friend Alan McLeod, very good journalist. I think he's one of the best out that we have now on the left. And I just want to read through this because I think it is the best kind of summary of information that we have on the Australian Strategic Policy Institute all put together. I could go over it on my own and put together some less, coordinated resources, but he put it all together in this article, so why not share it? So he wrote this for Mint Press News, and it's called ASBI, the government-funded conspiracist think tank now controlling your social media feed. And so this article was written relatively recently. Mint Press News doesn't always put the dates on their articles until the end of the article. So let me just look at that really quick. That was in June 2nd. No, that's a different article. Here we go. Looks like they changed their... Okay, this isn't that important, but let's see. So sometimes they have it like in blog role. So yeah, this was January 20th. This was just 6 months ago, less than 6 months ago. So while you're here, continue to like this stream, hit that like button, hit it, boost this stream in the algorithm, share it around, make sure you're sharing it, subscribe to the channel. And of course, I'm about $100 or so shy of my goal overall. My goal for Patreon. So patreon.com/DannyHaiFong, about $100 a month short. I'm very close to meeting my goal. So I really appreciate all of your support up until this moment. But let's get to the article. All right. So Alan McLeod says, social media giant Twitter raised many eyebrows recently when it announced that it had partnered with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in its fight against disinformation and fake news. ASBI Twitter revealed in a blog post had helped identify thousands of accounts that amplified Chinese Communist Party narratives around China's treatment of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. These accounts have now been permanently deleted. This is of concern because the ultra-hawkish Australian think tank is actually the source of many of the world's most incendiary claims about China in its foreign policy, and as Australian journalist and filmmaker John Pilger told Mint Press, has been a driving force in ramping up tensions between China and the West, something he explored in his 2016 documentary, The Coming War on China, a very good documentary. Pilger stated that, quote, ASBI has played a leading role, some would say the leading role, in driving Australia's mendacious and self-destructive and often absurd China-bashing campaign. the current coalition government, perhaps the most right-wing and incompetent in Australia's recent history, has relied on the ASBI to disseminate Washington's desperate strategic policies, into which much of the Australian political class, along with his intelligence and military structures, has been integrated. Importantly, neither ASBI nor Twitter claimed that the deleted accounts were fake or were operated by the Chinese state, strongly implying that merely agreeing with Beijing or questioning bellicose Western narratives was the reason to be banned. This is not the first time that Twitter has joined forces with the ASPI. In 2020, it announced that on the think tank's recommendations, it had shut down more than 170,000 accounts that praised China's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, generally, quote, antagonized, end quote, the U.S., or amplified, quote, unquote, deceptive narratives about the Hong Kong protests, i.e. ones that did not agree with the State Department or the 44% of Hong Kongers who supported the movement. In the same call, Twitter also deleted thousands of Russian and Turkish accounts. So that was what I was showing you there earlier in Twitter's report. That a global social media platform is now in open partnership with the ASPI should be trouble anyone who is concerned with free speech or peace, as the think tank is funded by the U.S. government and the world's largest weapons manufacturers, and has consistently agitated for global conflict. So, faux independence. The Australian Strategic Policy Institute describes itself as quote-unquote independent, nonpartisan think tank whose mission is to nourish public debate and understanding and better inform the public, as well as to produce expert and timely advice for Australian and global leaders. It insists that it is not identified with any particular ideology and is committed to publishing a wide range of views on contentious topics. Oh, I added wide, but just a range of views on contentious topics, which I don't know if you've ever met Nathan Rooser or any of these other. I think Vicky Hsu has contributed to this. If you've ever met these very hawkish anti-China types at the ASPI, you know that they don't really publish a range of views. They have one view, and that is China is quote-unquote bad and you all need to get on board or face consequences. Despite claiming to be independent, it also notes that it was established in 2001 by the Australian government, the sole owner of the organization. This represents a PR problem for the think tank, which warns that the perception as well as the reality of that independence need to be carefully maintained. Its annual financial reports reveal that most of its funding comes straight from Canberra, although it receives hefty donations from other governments, including the United Kingdom, Canada, Japan, and the Netherlands. While the lion's share of its funding comes from various sources within the Australian government, the vast majority of its overseas funding comes from Washington, and more specifically, the Department of Defense, over $700,000 in fiscal year 2020 to 2021, and the State Department, around $430,000 over the same period. In addition, ASBI takes money from American tech giants such as Google, Microsoft, Oracle, and Facebook. For many, including Australian diplomat Bruce High, this foreign cash has fundamentally sullied the organization. High told Mint Press, ASBI is the propaganda arm of the CIA and the U.S. government. It is a mouthpiece for the Americans. It is funded by the American government and American arms manufacturers. Why is it allowed to sit at the center of the Australian government when it has so much foreign funding? I don't know. If it were funded by anybody else, it would not be where it is at. As High noted, ASBI is also funded by a cavalcade of the world's largest weapons companies, including Boeing, Lockheed Martin, BAE Systems, Kinetic Q, and Thales. Perhaps even more worryingly, many of ASBI's key personnel moonlight as defense contractor executives. Indeed, almost half of its senior counsel are on the board of weapons and cybersecurity firms. Robert Hill is a case in point. As Minister of Defense in 2001 to 2006, he was one of the key figures driving Australia towards war in Iraq. Hill consistently lied to the public, claiming that it was not in dispute that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and that the occupation, in fact, saved many Iraqi lives. One former senior defense advisor, Jane Airy, claimed she was even forced out of her job after she refused to lie to the media on Hill's behalf about Iraqi WMDs. Today, he is on the board of Rheinmetall Defense Australia, a company that supplies fighting vehicles and ammunition to the Australian military. So here you have basically not just a weapons contractor, Defense Department funded think tank, but you have it basically controlled and run by people who drove Australia, who drove the Western world into war in Iraq, They are essentially just carrying water for the military industrial complex. That's all ASPI is. So it's no wonder why they're coming after people like myself, why they come after people who tell the truth about imperialism. So I'm gonna move on here because we can go on and on about ASPIs. So let's look at ASPI's life began 20 years ago as a relatively small think tank with a mandate to produce timely and independent research. However, in recent years, the organization has ballooned in size and now employs dozens of full-time staffers. Contrary to its original vision, its aggressive targeting of funding from a wide range of sources has undermined its credibility. ASPI's charter requires it to work to maintain the perception as well as the actuality of independence. Given the widespread criticism directed at ASPI in recent years due to the perceived excessive influence of the U.S. government, U.S. arms and cybersecurity multinational on its output, there is little doubt that the perception of its independence has been lost. Nevertheless, its ascendancy has led to carrying inordinate influence within Australian politics and beyond. The organization's reports being frequently cited in major outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post, and Fox News. Diplomat Hai said, ASPI has supplanted the Department of Foreign Affairs in advice to the government. The Minister of Foreign Affairs, Maïs Payne, is really very weak and has been surpassed or bypassed. So ASPI is feeding straight into the Prime Minister's office on matters of foreign policy, particularly as it relates to China. This is part of the militarization of Australia and the Australian public service. So again, this think tank is really, I think, a conduit of Washington. It is really a cutout of Washington, of the Washington foreign policy establishment. And it is literally advising and honestly running Australia's foreign policy, which, you know anything about Australia? Australia has for decades, right? Australia has been for decades a puppet of the United States. It has not really had an independent government, an independent, especially around foreign policy. But this is just a blatant, obvious sort of indication of that. Unsurprisingly, for an organization taking money from weapons contractors, ASPI publishes some of the most crude and relentless pro-war propaganda anywhere and has been a leader to rush to declare a new Cold War on China and Russia. This militaristic attitude is exemplified in ASPI's executive director, Peter Jennings. Last year, Jennings bitterly denounced Joe Biden and his decision to pull out of Afghanistan, describing it as his first big blunder in office. Jennings confidently predicted that Biden's assessment that the U.S. could not create or sustain a durable Afghan government would be proven wrong. In fact, it is precisely what American, Australian, and other forces delivered to Afghanistan, a flawed but functioning democracy, keeping the Taliban at bay and preventing groups such as Al-Qaeda from using Afghanistan as a training base from which to attack the West, he wrote. Later that year, the Afghan government would fall to the Taliban only days after American troops finally withdrew. In the same article, Jennings went on to state that Biden's decision was an abandonment as complete as the U.S. failure back in South Vietnam in the face of North Vietnam's advancing conventional forces in 74 and 75, thereby signaling that he supported the Vietnam conflict as well. Indeed, it is hard to find a war Jennings has not advocated for. He voraciously backed the Iraq War, even demanding in 2015 that Australia increase its troop numbers. A committed Cold Warrior who has argued that the West is setting the bar for military response too high and that the world must stop the Leninist autocracies of Russia, Iran, and Syria. Last week, he came close to calling for war against nuclear-armed Russia. America's credibility is on the line in Ukraine, he thundered, demanding that Biden back up his talk with believable military options. So that's before the Russia-Ukraine conflict, I guess you could say, sparked, right? That's before you had Russia putting in its special military operation. You had people like Peter Jennings say, now we got to go to war now. We got to be interventionists. We have to start this war with Russia over Ukraine. So this is who runs the ASPI. Just complete and utter warmongers. So for a think tank that was supposed to produce nonpartisan expert advice, it is remarkable how far ASPI strays from this goal, going so far as to run advertisements for weapons manufacturers masquerading as serious analysis. One example of this is a 2020 study titled, Australia Needs to Ensure It Has Advanced Missiles That It Needs. Comparing death machines to crucial life-saving equipment, it states, missiles are like a combination of a medical ventilator and the masks health workers need during a pandemic. You need many thousands of them and they can't be reused. Ordering or holding a few hundred just doesn't cut any mustard outside of peacetime training routines. So production is key. I mean, think about that. Look at this is how craven and sociopathic and just utterly lusting for death these military contractors are. They are absolute vultures. They are murderers. And to even, it's just sickening. It makes me sick to think about these rich capitalist assholes who profit off of mass murder, literally comparing their profits, their need to profiteer from war, to the medical equipment that health workers need to survive a pandemic. I mean, that's how disgusting capitalism is. That's how disgusting this imperialist system is. So anyway, we can go on and on and on about Peter Jennings. He continued, about the ASBI. So the author continues that without such weapons, the Islamic State might still control chunks of territory in Iraq and Syria. This claim, of course, ignores the fact that it was largely Iranian forces under Qassem Soleimani that were responsible for destroying ISIS and that the United States assassinated him in 2020. ASBI chief Peter Jennings appeared to support Trump's decision, writing that it's surely positive that after Soleimani's death, bad actors in the region might pause to wonder if a Hellfire missile on a circling drone has their name and address programmed in it. Oof. Hammering the point home, ASBI claims that Australia is fortunate in having close relationships with companies like Raytheon, Rafael, Lockheed Martin, and Kongsberg that can close the country's supposed missile supply gap. Getting agreement to and support for high-end U.S. missiles like the long-range anti-ship missile made by Lockheed Martin to be manufactured in Australia as well as the continental U.S. through co-production will only happen if senior leadership of our nation drives it, it concludes. If we're not clear that this was a buy more missiles, says group funded by missile manufacturers advertisement, ASBI included Thales, Lockheed Martin, and Lockheed Martin's logos on the page. Indeed, every page on ASBI's website includes a sidebar advertisement for those two companies, complete with links to their website. Actually, I can show you that. I'll be right back to that one, but I want to show you what Alan McLeod means. Okay, so I actually just pulled up. Where is it? Here we go. Shangri-La Dialogue. So I found this really hilarious because there you see Thales and Lockheed Martin, the two military contractors, advertisements with links to their website right next to this article. And I just found this hilarious because the title of this so-called article is Shangri-La Dialogue: Sovereignty Means Being Free to Choose. So I guess it's pretty ironic that the ASBI would say that the dialogue, it's crucial because the Shangri-La Dialogue is happening now. It's Asian states coming together. China's there as well, talking about security. And here you have the ASBI saying that sovereignty means being free to choose, as it is basically a mouthpiece for the major military contractors in the world. So I just thought that was hilarious. And I wanted to show you all that to understand what Alan McLeod means when he is talking about, so I'm going to get back to the article here, but when he's talking about what ASBI does. So continue to hit that like button while you're waiting for this article to come back up. Please boost this stream. So continuing on now. So these sorts of practices would be problematic enough if ASBI were a think tank trying to promote orange juice drinking in Australia while being filled with executives from Tropicana and Minute Maid. But if it's not fruit ASBI is selling, it is war. It is literally a life and death affair. So, you know, we're going to continue here about how racist ASBI is, okay? And then we'll move on. But I definitely think that this is just, I mean, this is just a great article on just how deep the ASBI is. And we're going to get into how deep it is on our social media. So saber rattling at Russia are running unofficial advertorials for weapons companies are sidelines to the ASBI's main business of hyping the threat that China poses to Australia and the world. Earlier this month, Jennings took to the pages of The Australian to demand more formal military alliance with Japan in order to take China head on. The Rupert Murdoch-owned newspaper failed to disclose the fact that Jennings's organization, and therefore his hefty salary, around $332,000 per year, is being directly paid in part by the Japanese government. He has also recently called for a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming Beijing Winter Olympics. So that happened a while ago. So again, this was written in January. ASBI is the source behind the infamous was the source behind the infamous 2019 documentary Red Flags, which aired on the straight broadcaster ABC. Not ABC, like the corporate media ABC in out here in the United States, but ABC is Australian Broadcasting Corporation. In McCarthyist fashion, Red Flags claimed that Australian universities were infiltrated with thousands of agents of the Chinese Communist Party leading Australian secrets and learning Australian secrets and bringing them back to their homeland. ASBI's report, Picking Flowers, Making Honey, insisted that universities were active in collaboration with the Communist Party of China. And here you have John Pilger talking about just how absolutely yellow peril conspiracy theories are deeply echoed by the ASBI. So the Canberra-based think tank was also behind the scaremongering that led the Australian government canceling Huawei's contract to upgrade the country's notoriously poor telecommunications infrastructure. Adding to the hype, one ASBI employee even took to the pages of a national newspaper to claim that if the small city of Bendigo went forward with its plan to attach Huawei sensors to their garbage trucks, it would constitute a national security threat. Jennings hailed the government's subsequent decision to cancel the nation's 5G plans as an absolutely the right call, categorizing those opposing it as simply the inevitable winning of China's Red Brigade of useful idiots. At no point did he acknowledge that telecom giants who fund ASBI and on whose boards many of its key members sit would likely benefit from the decision. So there you have the ASBI acolyte, Vicky Shu, today at the cab line in the airport. When I explained I'm concerned we're heading to war with China, she said, "We're already at war with China." I said, "No, a real war." She replied, "I'm in a real war with China." I mean, this is how absolutely craven these people are. I mean, this is what the ASBI is. It's absolutely incredible. Last summer, the ASBI published a report with the title, China Threatens Australia with a Missile Attack. The basis of the threat was not China, however, but a two-paragraph statement from Hu Xijin, the editor of the Chinese newspaper, The Global Times. Hu wrote that if Australia declared war on China, sent troops to Taiwan, and started killing Chinese soldiers, then China would have the capability to fire back on Australia. The author of the piece, Paul Dibb, the former head of Australia's equivalent of the Defense Intelligence Agency, surely knew the difference, but did not let that get in the way of a good story. Dibb himself openly ramped up tensions between the two nations. In 2020, he wrote an article for the ASBI titled How Australia Can Deter China. The article was illustrated simply with a picture of a Lockheed Martin missile. Pilger told Mint Press, ASBI is one of the world's most blatant propaganda ciphers. If we were back in the old Cold War, it would be the equivalent of Pravda. Though my memory of Pravda is that it was as honest in its role as a voice of the state, whereas ASBI pretends to be independent. So, you know, we're going to keep going. This article is quite long. Let's see how much longer we got. Yeah. Okay, I think we can get through this before 2 o'clock. But I mean, this is just an extremely informative article. For a think tank that claims to be a guardian against fake news and disinformation online, ASBI has been at the forefront of mainstreaming conspiracy theories about COVID-19 in China, particularly that of the Wuhan lab leak. In a report called The Great COVID Cover-Up, ASBI insisted that there has been massive worldwide collusion on the part of scientific, academic, and medical communities, even from parts of the U.S. government, all to hide COVID's true origins and run interference for China. Perhaps most importantly, however, ASBI is a worldwide driving force bringing the treatment of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang to global attention. There are many reports, particularly the ongoing Xinjiang Data Project, have been the basis of hundreds of articles and news segments across the planet. Unfortunately, much of their research is as sloppy as has other aspects of as it has been with other projects. As soon as it released an interactive map of the locations of what it claimed were hundreds of Uyghur detention centers, local Chinese people and even individuals using tools like Google were able to show conclusively that many of these quote-unquote prisons were actually schools, government offices, and other mundane edifices. So here you have Cheng Xinpan say that ASBI reports Turnpan Detention Center, Facility Number 7 and Facility Number 1, turn out to be Guochang District Bureau for Veteran Affairs and Guochang District Bureau for Business and Industry Information, respectively. The smoking gun is that they both have external walls. I mean, this is how pathetic it is. So, of course, this is not to say that no detention facilities exist or that a great number of Uyghurs have not been oppressed or imprisoned. Even the Chinese government accepts that it has put a large number of people through what it describes as de-radicalization programs. What it does highlight, though, is the sloppy nature of scholarship that is being used to justify a worldwide boycott of Xinjiang-linked companies on the grounds of forced labor, something that the ASBI has helped lead. Thus, ASBI is far from a neutral arbiter in Twitter's decision to close thousands of accounts on the grounds of stopping misinformation about Xinjiang spreading. In fact, It is serving as the prosecutor, the judge, and executioner all at once. Ironically, at least 11 of the think tank's largest financial backers are themselves heavily implicated in using forced labor to produce their weapons or in human trafficking. Boeing, Raytheon, BAE Systems, and Lockheed Martin all make use of forced American prison labor to make their products, while certain national sponsors, including the United States and the UAE, engage in forced labor. The organization that constantly attacks China was also among the driving forces behind years-long Russiagate conspiracy in the United States. ASBI agents were flown across the world to provide supposedly expert testimony to the U.S. Senate hearings about alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election. Remarkably, ASBI's reports hacking democracies, claims that only Russia and China interfere in other nations' elections, blithely ignoring the history of American government doing just that. So I'm not going to continue this. I think we get the picture, I think, because this goes into other connections. But I want to focus on this. Really, the point here is that this ASBI is working with Twitter, is completely connected with the Australian government, the U.S. government, the military apparatus, the military state, the military industrial complex, all these forces together. It is really acting as kind of the brain of the imperialist apparatus. It is the academic side, right? Because the academic side, it's always been there with imperialism, but it has escalated. It has escalated. The relationship between the academy, academia, and the military-industrial complex and imperialism has only become stronger. And these think tanks, like the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, are a major component of this. So we have to understand that when we see that there are accounts, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of accounts being taken down, then we really have to pause and say what's behind it. And oftentimes what is actually behind it is collaboration among these Silicon Valley big tech corporations and think tanks like the ASPI. This is a coordinated campaign. So those who are supposedly attacking me, acting like they're somehow independent, I believe that there's enough suspicion here to warrant that if anyone is taken down for saying particular things about China, that it can be connected to this campaign. So kudos to Alan McLeod for that. Kudos to Alan McLeod for that article, because I think it gets to a lot of what we have been experiencing of late and what I just experienced talking about Tiananmen Square. And so, you know, this is going to continue, and we have to just be very aware of it. We have to be sure to combat it, right? There's just, you know, this is going to continue, and it's happening. You know, Ben Norton reported not too long ago as well that this has happened to Venezuelan accounts, Nicaraguan accounts, especially Nicaraguan accounts being taken down in the lead up to the re-election of Daniel Ortega, that there were, you know, tens of thousands of accounts that were deleted. And now look at this, the Communist Party of the Philippines is calling out Twitter for censorship of its accounts as well. And this was just 7 days ago, last week. The Communist Party of the Philippines today, so this was June 4th, is a statement revealed that its affiliated accounts were suspended by Twitter on its social media platform without any warning. These said accounts served as platforms for the Philippine Revolutionary Movement to express its views, share statements, and update people on its activities. So the chief information officer, Marco Valbuena of the Communist Party of the Philippines, said that the following accounts and that of the National Democratic Front of the Philippines, chief political consultant Jose Maria Sison, were suspended yesterday as of June 3rd. So this is going to keep happening, because this is really a war on any kind of legitimate dissent, especially those who are championing socialism, multipolarity, independence, national liberation. This is a war on all of that, because these big tech corporations know how much of a monopoly they have on information now, because the age of information is not merely that, oh, now we have all this amazing, wonderful access to be able to inform ourselves without perhaps the corporate arm of the state kind of pushing us in one direction or the other. No, this is not some information free-for-all. This information is tightly in the hands of a few corporations. Twitter, these big Silicon Valley corporations, they are monopolies. They are monopolizing the social media space, and billions of people consume news information through these venues. They have created, right, a real convenient weapon, because whenever monopolies, because capitalism always has a tendency to monopolize. So whenever monopolies begin to concentrate and form, then the relationship with the state becomes all the more stronger, because there is a vested interest in these monopolies to ensure that their interests are protected by the state. And then the state has a vested interest in protecting their interests in order to, of course, you know, reelect, get representatives, quote unquote, reelected, get their political class reelected, establish their power, and to maintain hegemony on the political level, at the policy level. So this is what's happening with social media, and it's only going to get harder and harder and harder for people like us. So with that said, I'm going to move on to the next story. But while you are here, continue to like this stream, subscribe to the channel, make sure you're hitting that notifications bell. And I'm about $100 a month shy, just $100 per month shy of my goal on Patreon. So please do subscribe there to support this journalism at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. You can find all the links of how to support me in the description of this video. So, you know, I think I'm going to go quickly through what I think is an important story. I really wanted to get Richard Medhurst, but he's very busy during the work days, I feel. So I really wanted to get him to talk about this, but hopefully soon that will happen, that we can collaborate on this. But I wanted to talk about Syria, because I haven't done it in a while. And you may not know, but Syria is a huge influence on my politics. So right after the invasion of Libya, you all know that the United States then engaged in a dirty war on Syria, right around the same time, right around that March 2011 period, right? And the United States waged an unconventional war on Syria as it was building up toward a U.S. NATO invasion of Libya, which would happen that October. And Muammar Gaddafi would be ruthlessly assassinated, the state would be overthrown, and the region of Northern Africa would be thrown into chaos, and that would have a direct influence on what would happen in Syria, because a lot of these so-called quote-unquote rebels that were fighting, these terrorists, these jihadists, would actually make their way into Syria to commit atrocities and try to overthrow the Syrian government. And so this was really my first, you could say, foray into anti-war, anti-imperialist politics, getting to the bottom of Libya and then getting to the bottom of Syria. I did a lot of good work in Boston, the Boston area, with the Syrian American Forum, doing educationals, holding rallies. We led this huge rally in Boston that the FBI was conducting surveillance on. It got broken up by agent provocateurs. There were drones in the skies. I mean, it was an absolutely intense moment at that period when the Obama administration was considering, that summer of 2013, you remember this, it was 2014, I believe, the United States was considering airstrikes on Syria. And this was incredibly dangerous, right? So Syria doesn't make the news as much anymore. And one of the reasons why, beginning in 2015-16, Russia intervened, right, on the side of Syria. Syria then escalated its campaign of sovereignty and self-defense and really won, right? Around 2016, I believe Aleppo was liberated. And then from then on, right, it was a battle for Idlib. And while 30% or so of the country remains occupied by U.S. military forces, and while jihadists still are wreaking havoc to a degree, the war has died down a lot. It's really ground to a stagnating halt, which is why the U.S. put on CSER sanctions, these horrific sanctions, which absolutely destroyed Syria's economy. And it's why airstrikes continue in Syria. But the government isn't going to be overthrown. And one of the things you never hear about is how Israel actually conducts regular airstrikes against Syria. And so Israel, from the very beginning, it wasn't talked about all that much, even during the height of this so-called civil war, which is how the West would portray it. But with this dirty war that the United States was leading, not many people knew that Israel was actually providing, from the Golan Heights, medical supplies and help to these jihadists, and they were providing weapons. So Israel occupies a large chunk of Syria in the Golan Heights. And that occurred because of the 67 war of aggression by Israel, which the United States was certainly has culpability in. And it was able to keep the Golan Heights as its territory. And it has been helping these so-called quote-unquote rebels ever since. And it seems like every other day, and this has been happening for years, this has been happening throughout the war. Seeing every other day, Israel bombs Syria. And so Israel actually just committed a war crime in Syria, and it's not being talked about. Israel on June 10th, late morning, June 10th, I guess you could say early morning, June 10th, I guess we could say, Israel bombed Syria's airport in Damascus, its biggest airport. This is a war crime. And I'm going to pull up an article by The Cradle to show you just a report on what happened. So the Damascus International Airport was crippled in latest attacks by Israel. The most recent Israeli aerial aggression on Syria on June 10th damaged functional capacity of Damascus's international airport, according to the Syrian state news agency Sana. The Syrian Ministry of Transportation said that all flights were suspended as a result of the Israeli attack on airstrips and the navigation lights, as well as damage caused to the airport. The damage was extensive, targeting the runways, navigation, and other airport infrastructure. This is civilian infrastructure that Israel is targeting. I mean, Israel regularly kills Syrian Arab army forces, civilians, but this is bombing civilian infrastructure. This is a war crime by the Geneva Convention standpoint. Civil aviation personnel and national component companies are working together to fix the damages, the ministry noted. Passenger and cargo flights will only resume once the necessary repairs are completed. Damascus International Airport is a key lifeline between the Islamic Republic of Iran and various resistance groups in Lebanon and Palestine, who receive military, financial, and other forms of support, with Syria as a transit stop. Many believe the disrupting services in the airport is likely to put a strain on Tehran's steady support to Lebanese and Palestinian armed resistance groups. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova conveyed Moscow's condemnation of the attack and demanded that Israel stop these evil practices. Russia reiterates that consistent Israeli aggression on the Syrian Arab Republic's territory poses violation of the basic rules of international law, the Russian official said. Such irresponsible actions pose grave threats to the international air transport and puts innocent souls at risk. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian also reached out to a Syrian counterpart to condemn the attack. The attack on June 10th that badly damaged Damascus International Airport was a second attack in just 1 week, with the preceding one taking place on June 6th. Last month, in a letter to the UN, Syria's Ministry of Foreign Affairs demanded that the UN issue a clear condemnation of frequent airstrikes by Israel on its territory. The letter was sent to the UN Secretary General and the President of the UN Security Council, who said Damascus hoped that the two UN bodies would adopt a clear position on the Israeli attacks on Syrian sovereignty. The Syrian ministry urged the UN to encourage that Israel abides by the relevant Security Council resolution and end its attacks on the region. So, I mean, there you have it. War crime by Israel. And predictably enough, the United Nations can't come to its defense because the United Nations is dominated by the United States. And the United States is absolutely beholden to Israel. Not because Israel is the puppeteer of the United States, but because the United States needs Israel. It needs Israel as a geostrategic kind of beachhead in the region in order to subvert any kind of Arab nationalism, any kind of nationalism of any kind in the region that seeks sovereignty. And Israel, of course, right, wants to prevent any accountability on the Palestine question, any kind of unity in the region, which once did exist, at least to a stronger degree, pre-1967, right? That did exist between Egypt, between Syria, between the Palestinian liberation movement. I mean, there was a more robust pan-Arab movement at that time. But it had been beaten back. It has been beaten back so many times over and over and over again by the imperialists. And Israel is doing these bombings every other day as part of this larger strategy. Israel has two key documents. One of them is called the Yanan Plan, written in the early 1980s. And the other is the Clean Break document, which Benjamin Netanyahu was the prime minister at the time. He had a hand in writing this document. And both of these documents stipulate that the principal objective of Israel is to expand into a greater Israel, quote unquote, by essentially overthrowing any challenge to its expansionism. And that means taking down all of the independent Arab governments, all of the independent governments in the region that seek to integrate themselves and create economic, political, and military alliances, which essentially negate and oppose Israel's colonialist ambitions, right? That is what Israel has been all about over the last several decades. That is what its entire imperialist and colonialist foreign policy is about. It is about Palestine, and then it's about more than Palestine, because Israel just doesn't see Palestine as the only legitimate part of its what it wants, which is a colonialist empire, right? It wants to expand more. And so I want to show you just how frequent these attacks are. So this was written in October of 2021 in Al-Bawaba, which is I don't know where it exactly is based. I couldn't find that. I tried to find that earlier. Let's see. Abawaba. So it just says Middle East. I hate when they just say Middle East, like where in the Middle East. Anyway, so it is based in the region. This is a really good article. Okay. I just want to read quickly through some of it to show you just how frequent these attacks are, because it goes over a little bit of this. Israel's deadly war games over the Syrian airspace. And it says, cynically, Syria is Israel's target practice shot. It has been this way certainly since 2011, when the beleaguered Arab Spring and the consequent civil war engulfed the country. It would be wrong to assume that Israel is a bystander in the Syrian conflict, as it has always claimed. Israel is a major clandestine power with regards to Damascus, standing alongside other interventionist states like Iran, Russia, the United States, Turkey. Okay, I don't know what this means. One would have asked himself, why would Israel want to be in bed with all these other states and terrorist organizations? It's a complicated question worth dwelling on. So Israel's presence in Syria is not on the ground as it is with other powers and forces in regards to the country, starting from the south of Damascus and upwards to Aleppo and more, as its airspace has to do, okay, so this is really bad translation. And hence Israel uses the country from the airspace as from the air as target practice. What this means, according to different mediums and media reports, is that it has launched hundreds of strikes over different cities in the country in the course of the last decade. So hundreds of times. Israel has refused to confirm these attacks, but occasionally there has been those in the Jewish army and its military generals who did confirm the missile strikes and bombings over Syria, as stated by Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Aviv Kovachi in an interview with Jerusalem Post. He said in 2020, Israeli warplanes hit 500 targets in addition to multiple clandestine missions. In terms of the trajectories, it can be imagined that these would be in the thousands, but Kovachi prefers to keep tight-lipped about that. So this is just since 2020. We're talking about hundreds of targets, hundreds, that means hundreds of bombs, hundreds of sorties on Syria. So, I mean, this is how frequent it is. And I don't really like the politics of this article. It's kind of like an op-ed. But I just wanted to show you that it's very tight-lipped, as this article said. It's kind of, they attempt to keep it secret because the Western media is completely blacked out on this. They don't cover Israel's nearly daily bombings of Syria. They don't cover it. So that article suggested that Israel is using Syria as a target practice. But it didn't say why. Why would it want to practice targeting Syria? It could aim its missiles anywhere. It could aim its missiles in a neutral place, right? It doesn't have to fire on civilian infrastructure like airports. Well, Israeli media will tell you that the reason why it does this is to stop Iran, is to stop Iran's influence, is to stop Iran's assistance to Hezbollah and any other organization that is hostile to Israel's interests. But the real reason is that what Iran's solidarity, what Syria, Iran, Hezbollah's, and the whole axis of resistance, what their solidarity represents is a rebuke of Israeli expansionism. That Israel wants to get rid of all of these threats. It wants to do it one by one by one. It wants the United States and it wants all of the United States' allies to do its bidding to protect its interests, because that is the only way, in Israel's eyes, Israel sees this as a huge point of leverage, because Israel is required and needed by the United States for geopolitical reasons, that Israel's location and its ability to cause havoc actually does help the U.S.'s foreign policy ambitions in the region, because the United States also wants to get rid of these problems, right? The United States has been waging wars of regime change, covert and overt at times, right? The assassination of Soleimani, early 2020, right? I was in China when that happened. We were all in shock when it happened, when the Trump administration assassinated Soleimani. But of course, we know that Israel has a huge role in all of that, because Israel wants Iran weak, it wants Syria weak, it wants Hezbollah weak, it wants all countries that have the potential to challenge its expansionism to be weak and ultimately to be overthrown. And the strategy has been so bankrupt over the last few decades, especially over the last decade. The strategy has been in Syria to create absolute and total chaos in the region through arming jihadist groups. These groups that supposedly once were at odds with the United States in the quote-unquote war on terror, and all of their allies said they were at odds with them, without any remembering or attempt to remember the history of how the United States actually covertly funded a lot of these groups and organizations in order to undermine the Soviet Union in Afghanistan beginning in 1979. I mean, this is how craven, this is how sociopathic, this is how cynical imperialism is. It's all about achieving the interests of the imperialists, of the profiteers, and it's all about gaining the political conditions necessary to do that. And in this moment, right, 2011 was really a watershed crescendo moment, because what it pointed to was that the United States had nothing else to offer, nothing left to do, even militarily, than wreak havoc, wreak chaos, arm, fund, and completely support the very groups that have no possibility of maintaining any kind of stability in the region, so that even the United States and their partner and its partners could plunder Syria, right? You think you're going to get plunder Syria by putting al-Nusra Front and ISIS in power? Well, look at what happened in Libya. Libya became an absolute internal disaster, a failed state. And Libya has not been a boon as corporations thought it was going to be, right? So there is a tension there. There's a tension there. But it doesn't mean that there really has been any anti-war opposition to these imperialist wars, because there hasn't been. There really hasn't been any opposition, even in the establishment, even though the establishment knows that Caesar sanctions, daily bombings, putting Syria into complete and utter instability. The same goes with Iran, right? Trying to continue to starve Iran. None of that is in the interest even of, let's say, European capital. European capital would love to have even deeper relations with Iran if it wasn't for their U.S. masters saying no. And now we see that repeating with Russia over the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And what we're seeing is really just a decline of an empire. These airstrikes by Israel are just another indicator of the decline of the American-led empire, which Israel is a part of. It is an admission that there is nothing left for this empire to do but to shoot at its targets, but to try to destroy all of its targets militarily, and to do so in really the most unconventional counterinsurgency warfare type ways, which don't always go as planned, because you cannot trust al-Nusra, you cannot trust ISIS, you can't trust any of these armed groups to be your foot soldiers, right? The United States has learned this over and over and over again, but the strategy remains the same. And I think there's a reason why we see slowly, but then rapidly, from Obama, Trump to Biden, this shift to Russia and China, because the strategy has failed. Syria is not going to fall. Iran is not going to fall. So now the imperialists are looking for a total strategy, right, to confront the powers that they hoped they could get to through a domino effect. Because a lot of this, Syria, Iran, right, a lot of what happened to Afghanistan, Syria, Iran, Iraq, all of these countries that the United States has destroyed or attempted to destroy, it was all to weaken Russia, to weaken China, and it hasn't worked. The integration projects of Russia and China have moved forward. These countries, many of them, have at least been able to remain sovereign. Some of them, like Iran, have been able to actually become more stable. Syria has been able to defy all odds. So it hasn't worked out as planned. And that means that the United States and its allies are looking now at Russia and China as the only real confrontation left, right? Because the strategy of total chaos is not really panning out. It pans out for the profiteers, so it's not 100%, but I'm talking about strategy, geopolitical strategy. It is panning out for the profiteers. It is panning out for the military industrial complex. But in terms of being able to shore up the interests of capital as a whole, that's a whole nother story. And I think that's why we see these desperate attempts to weaken Russia, to weaken China. And it's almost like a back and forth between, do we go after the perceived weaker states and try to undermine Russia and China through their destruction? And when that doesn't work, then can we undermine Russia and China to also weaken and undermine these perceived weaker states, right? Like Syria, like Iran, like Venezuela. You know, we can go on and on and on. But, you know, there you have it. There is the reality of the situation when it comes to Syria. Syria is being bombed. It's this victim of war crimes by Israel. And we should be saying that. Israel is committing war crimes in Syria, against Syria. We should be repeating that over and over and over again for as long as we can, and for as long as it takes for the situation to change, and for the anti-imperialist movement, whatever is left of it in the U.S. and West, to get its head out of its ass and actually make it a priority. So with that said, continue to like this stream, continue to share this stream, help boost this algorithm, boost the boost. Like, hit that like button. And of course, I'm just $100 away per month from my goal. Just $100 per month away from my goal that I have for this year to really make this journalism work sustainable. You can subscribe at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong to help out my journalism. There's also links in the description, which you can look at in the description of this video, to support this work. I would greatly appreciate it. So let's move on to the last story, okay? Because I want to get on call-in with all of you, and I will make sure to share that link soon. Last but not least, some good news. And surprise, surprise, it happens to do with China. So I want to share a report. It was actually written a couple weeks ago by Newsweek. I was going to share the whole study, But, you know, I didn't really like the way the study read. I didn't think it was very accessible. I think its methodology is pretty hard to understand from the way it's described in the study. So let's just go to Newsweek that summarizes it. So Newsweek says most in China call their nation a democracy, and most in the U.S. say America is not a democracy. All right, so the overwhelming majority of people in China say they're living in democracy. This was written in May 30th, 2022. Most people in the United States say they don't. These findings are part of a new study published by Denmark-based Alliance for Democracies Foundation and Germany-based Latina data tracking firm. Part of the latest installment of the annual Democracy Perception Index published Monday, the study explores public opinions of democracy among 52,785 respondents across 53 nations and territories, including China and the U.S., surveyed between March 30th and May 10th of this year. When asked about whether they believe their country is democratic, those in China topped the list, with some 83% saying the communist-led People's Republic of China was a democracy. A resounding 91% said that democracy is important to them. But in the U.S., which touts itself as a global beacon of democracy, only 49% said their country was a democracy. And just three quarters of respondents, 76%, said democracy was important. A note accompanying the poll results offers a disclaimer stating that in quote-unquote authoritarian countries, positive perceptions might result from different conceptions of democracy, high levels of government satisfaction, or fear of speaking out against the government. Oh, of course, they have to put in fear of the government, right? Fear of the government is what makes people say certain things. Let me just tell you about fear of the government. People in the United States fear their government. People fear the police. They fear the prisons. They fear their politicians. How many people in the United States are even willing to try to confront their politicians? To try, I don't know if you remember when the Black Panther Party in 67, during the passage of the Mulford Act, they went to Congress. They went to the steps of the Capitol, and they occupied the Capitol with guns. How many times has that happened since then? And let's not talk about January 6th, which was, of course, not any kind of rebellion, right? It wasn't a rebellion in the sense that it was based in a mass movement. Right? How many people, though, have legitimately done that? No, people are afraid of their government in the United States, but yet there's all of this dissatisfaction. So I don't want to hear this idea that China's government somehow can strike more fear in the hearts of their people than the United States government does in theirs, because I think that's absolutely ridiculous and preposterous. There's no basis in reality. But then again, the other two explanations I think are more accurate. High levels of government satisfaction. Okay, what's wrong with that? Wouldn't that be part of what it means to be a democracy, right? You should be satisfied in the way your country is governed if and who is governing and what is governing it if you live in a quote-unquote democracy, right? Right? I don't know. Maybe I'm just stupid. I don't know. Or it might result from different conceptions of democracy. Well, no shit. China does conceive of democracy much different. There's a great video in The Coming War on China. I don't know if you saw it, but hold on 1 second. I don't know if you saw it. Eric Lee, who's a venture capitalist, who is a member of the Communist Party of China, it wasn't Eric Lee. Actually, I think it was Zhang Weiwei. He was interviewed for John Pilger's documentary, and he said that in China, right, unlike the United States, the government controls the capitalists. Capitalists in China do not control society. In the United States, capitalists control society. They control the government rather than the government controlling the capitalists. And that's the difference. That is how China conceives of democracy as being different. That in China, it would be absolutely criminal to even think about, capitalists controlling things, right? There would be a revolution, a second revolution in China, if that were the case. So anyway, moving on, those leading the list outside of China included countries with a mix of political systems: Switzerland, Vietnam, India, and Norway. So Latina political research consultant Frederick DeVoe told Newsweek that the eagerness displayed by those in single-party-led nations such as China and Vietnam describe their country as democratic may perhaps be a function of not wanting to speak out against the government. See, again and again and again. But he argued it could also be a real perception that their country is somehow acting in the interest of many people, and this is what democracy means. Oh, well, I guess it could be one or the other, right? It could be that everyone is just scared, or it could mean that they actually believe their governments are doing something for them. Because we actually have facts, right? Real facts that show that people are why people are satisfied. One, China's incredible response to COVID-19, which has prevented fewer than 6,000 people from dying of a pandemic that's been going on since the beginning of 2020, which has killed more than 1 million people in the United States. Well, maybe that's just one reason. Could be eliminating extreme poverty. It could be going from one of the poorest countries in the world 40 years ago to having state-of-the-art infrastructure, cheap public infrastructure, public transit, high-speed rail. Maybe it's about leading the climate change effort. I don't know. I would be inspired too if I lived in a country that led in both the distribution, production, and consumption of renewable energy, and where 99% of bus lines are electric, and where there are so many incentives to buy electric vehicles, or where 80% of people own their homes, 90% of young people. I would feel pretty good about my society if that were the case here in the United States, but it isn't. So maybe it isn't really about fear, because I don't know how much you can fear a government that is putting together those kind of material conditions. So I don't need to read any more of this. This is really just goes to show that the perceptions of democracy in China are very high. That not only do people value democracy, but in China, people believe they live in a democracy. It's not the same democracy that the United States believes itself to be, right? That's not the definition. So we have to be nuanced. We have to be sophisticated. And this to me is good news. It not only means that in China, there's people have hope, people have confidence, people believe that good things are happening, and they believe good things are happening because contrary to what others may say, to what detractors may say, good things are happening. But it's not just that. It's also that there is a debate about what democracy is. Is democracy just about voting Western-style elections in order to ensure that there's a government that protects the interests of the rich, of capital? Is that democracy? A dictatorship of capital, maybe? Or is it a government that truly does represent the interests of all people, is governed by a party that has at its core a revolutionary history of protecting the nation in the interests of all classes, especially the workers and the peasants, from foreign domination, from utter brutality and poverty, like the Communist Party of China? Could that be democracy? Could it be that there's a difference between bourgeois representative democracy and what China calls whole process people's democracy? Right? In China, kind of like in Libya and a lot of other countries that have socialist governance systems or had socialist governance systems, you call it direct democracy, right? You do have voting at the very smallest local level directly by the people at the village level, at the municipal level, at the very smallest level of community organization. You have voting, direct voting, right? People casting ballots for who will represent them. And then after that, you have those folks, those forces at the very smallest local level voting in who's going to represent you at the next level, the provincial level, the township level. Then you have those forces voting in who will represent you in the National Assembly, right? So you have a direct democratic system where it's not just one representative representing you at the national level. It's not this broken up thing. It's that you have direct linkages, right? From the very local level all the way to the top. And in China, they call it both a top-down and a bottom-up process. So the bottom-up is what builds the governance system. And then the top-down is the consultation that happens afterward, right? The consultation between bodies like the NPC and the China political consultative people's political consultative Congress, the CPPCC, going downward to the lower levels of the governance system and on up and down and up and down. It's about consultation and bottom-up communication, and that's how you get things done. That's why you have on social media, interestingly enough, people being consulted in China about policies, right? During the two sessions, that's what happens. People will get messages, right? What do you think about this policy from those that represent them at the various levels of government? And then people will talk about it. People will vote on it. And then those government officials will then take those answers and deliberate on them and make decisions, right? To me, that is what a direct democracy is versus what we have in the United States, which you vote in some representative of the bourgeoisie and you hope for the best, right? But really all you get is the worst. So there's one thing I want to also show you about China that I think is really interesting. And that is Bloomberg reported, I believe it was today. Yes, yesterday. Another aspect of China, you know, you hear about China and Africa all the time. China's terrible in Africa. China's terrible in Africa, right? And you hear about China being an imperialist country in Africa, right? Debt trap diplomacy. You saw last year with Uganda, they said China's closing an airport in Uganda because Uganda can't pay for it, right? Countries are just in debt and they're being plundered and China's taking all their resources. Like this ultimate projection of what Western imperialism in the United States have done through their multinational corporations and the international financial system since forever. But you have Bloomberg here talking about a survey that says that China surpasses the U.S. in the eyes of young Africans. China provides affordable goods, invests in infrastructure. Survey covers 18 to 24-year-olds on world's youngest continent. So this was written by Anthony Squazin, June 12, 2022, yesterday. China has overtaken the U.S. as the foreign power seen as having the biggest positive influence in Africa by young people, according to a survey released on Monday. A survey conducted by the Ishakowitz Family Foundation found that 76% of 4,507 young Africans, 4,507 young Africans across 15 countries named China as a foreign power with a positive influence on their lives, compared with 72% for the U.S. In 2020, when the inaugural study of 18-24-year-olds was conducted, 83% of respondents saw the U.S.'s influence as positive, while the figure for China was 79%. So still relatively high, but China is overtaken in just a couple of years in this poll. The results are further evidence that China is winning the battle against geopolitical rivals such as the U.S. and European Union for the hearts and minds of Africa. I'm not going to say Africans. This is really this language. Beijing has plowed money into African infrastructure over the plowed. See that wording? This is propaganda. Plowed. What kind of word choice is that? What do you think that means? When you say plowed, you're automatically indicating that this is a bad thing, that you're plowing over these countries by investing in African infrastructure. But it's plowed its money into African infrastructure over two decades and supplies the continent with affordable consumer goods ranging from mobile phones and solar panels to shovels and plastics. So high value and low value goods, essentially, is what they're saying. And a lot of the 4G, 5G technology that's built on the African continent, 100% of it is China. That's just the reality, guys. Have to face up to it. We see China as having climbed to a pole position. We see recognition of the fact that China is engaging in Africa at a time when very few others are. Ivor Ishakowitz, chairman of the foundation, said in an interview in Johannesburg, "In Africa, America has played a very, very limited role. It's actually played an embarrassingly insignificant role in terms of actual investment, actual trade, actual building of infrastructure." So I believe it was 2019 when this last number, the number I saw, or was it 2018? The last number I saw was that the United States had only about $39 billion invested in Africa through trade, and China had a whopping $250 billion. That disparity is only widened, right, in terms of total trade volume with the African continent. So there's just no competition. In addition to its vast mineral and energy resources, Africa has the world's most youthful population and is seen as a potential market for the future by countries ranging from France to India. In terms of perceived positive influence, the U.S. has now slipped behind the U.K. and EU as well. There's no question that China is the overall dominant player in Africa today. Overall, we're seeing a much more positive approach to China that's going to drive a lot more engagement with China. Positive sentiment toward China was the strongest in Rwanda, Malawi, and Nigeria. This survey, which involves lengthy face-to-face interviews, will be run annually. About 42% of the world's youth are expected to be in Africa by 2030. Still, China's influence is not seen as universally positive. 56% of those surveyed said they believe the unverified conspiracy theory that COVID-19 was developed intentionally spread by the Chinese government. The survey also showed, I would love to see that question. I'd love to see how leading that question was. The survey also showed that young Africans have lost faith in their own governments, are increasingly concerned about climate change and discrimination against women and ethnic minorities. Okay. Moving the goalposts, of course. That's what the Western media does. Moving the goalposts. So key findings from the survey, 32% of young Africans said they were excited and optimistic about the future of their countries, compared with 43% in the 2020 survey. Okay, so these are less China related. All right, so no, less important, but 39% said they wouldn't take a COVID-19 vaccine, blah, blah. So it's a broad survey, but the big gist of it is that African youth across African countries that were polled by this survey show that there is growing optimism about China, and there should be. The people-to-people exchanges, there are so many African students studying in China. There is investment in infrastructure and electricity and renewable energy and telecommunications and bridges and roads and railway. I mean, what is there not to be attracted to? So I think this is good news because it shows that there is a worldwide sentiment around, there is a global sentiment about the United States that it just isn't the influential force that it thinks it is. And that other forces around the world like China can be looked to as reliable. And we should take that as a huge indicator of where we need to go in terms of our own geopolitical understanding of things. We need to understand that China is not a force for quote unquote evil. It's not. Stop painting it like that. If that were the case, then we would see a lot different results. We would see different results from these polls, from these surveys. These polls and surveys have no interest in giving you even here top representatives, the chiefs, the heads of these organizations in both articles, from the Democracy Perception Index to that survey from the foundation about what African youth think about China and other things. They say that they're telling us they don't have any interest in this. They don't want this to be true. They don't want it to be true, but it is true. And when that happens, then we can verify that in fact the results have actual validity. They are valid because these Western institutions that don't want to see China succeed, they don't want to see China be perceived in this way, can't help but acknowledge that this is the case. They're not lying for China. They're not trying to do China's bidding. They are actually kind of at the mercy of their own methodologies, because the world is changing. It's shifting east. The East is rising. China's rising. Russia's rising. The multipolar world is rising. The global South sees it. The global South is part of it. They want to be part of it. They want real sovereignty. They want to modernize. They want a more egalitarian world order. They want peace. And now it's about us here in the United States. It's about us here in the imperialist orbit, in the citadels of empire, who now need to get our shit together and get more and more people on board, get our movements on board with this, fight the isolation of our movements in these silos, right? Whether it's the labor movement or the peace movement or any form of class struggle, the Black Lives Matter movement, all of it needs, we all need to work on getting these movements out of their silos, challenging the forces that are compelling that, labor leadership, nonprofit industrial complex, you name it, right? The liberal class, those who have a grip on our movements. We need to challenge it every step of the way so that we can move toward this anti-imperialist global internationalist outlook, because our movements won't succeed without it. They won't. So there's a lot of work to do on the ground, of course, not to negate the fact that we need to build up movements here in the United States that are targeted, that take up certain issues. But those movements cannot be single issue movements. They can't be movements led by a liberal or neoliberal imperialist leadership. We have to build new leadership, and that leadership has to be anti-imperialist. Because if it's not anti-imperialist, then it sure isn't socialist. And if it isn't socialist, then it sure isn't a solution for any of us. It isn't a solution for working people. It isn't a solution for oppressed people. It's only going to reinforce the madness. It's only going to make this empire a more effective evil. Okay, that's what it's going to do. So with that said, everyone, we are here at 90 minutes. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to first say thank you for coming to the stream so far. Please do like this stream, subscribe to the channel, hit that notifications bell. And while you're at it, please do consider, I am just $100 per month away from my goal. That's just $100 a month away from my goal, with about 6 months left in the year to reach this goal that I have in order to be able to sustain this journalism. I have a lot of people doing some volunteer work for me that I hope to give some money to as they work toward helping me with things like branding, helping me manage some of the administrative tasks. I don't have a producer. I would love to get one of those. So if you support these streams, this work that I do, my columns, please do subscribe on patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. Help me reach that goal. I'm under $100 a month, about $83 a month to be exact. You can do so in the links in the description. Patreon is down there. I love when people get on Substack. So if you can support annually on Substack and you prefer that, please do that. It's all in the link in the description. It goes a long way. But with that said, guys, a little bit of house cleaning. One, I am actually going to, in about 10 minutes, get on the call-in app, okay? I'm going to send that in the chat. I'm going to send the link to that in the chat, and then I am going to also put that in the video after I leave here. And you're going to want to join for that discussion. We're just going to have Q&A. I got to all the topics today, but I can, of course, continue to talk. But I'm going to do probably 30 to 45 minutes on there with all of you directly. So please do. And also Telegram, guys, Telegram. All right. I'm not moving there permanently. I'm still going to be on Twitter. I'm not going to just like give up Twitter, but I'm not going to be doing it as much. I'll be on there, but I am really going to be sharing all of my work on Telegram. I just put it in the link in the chat again. So you want to subscribe there, because that's an easy way to find out what I'm doing. And also I have a group there if you want to join where you can chat. I do answer as best I can. But I am going to actually close up the stream now, guys. So join me on call-in. I put the link in the chat. I don't see any super chats, but the best way to support my work, patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. That's the best way to support my work. You can do so in the link in the description. And yeah, one last piece of house cleaning. My sister is visiting me beginning on the 19th, really the 18th late at night, but the 19th really. So I'll probably be live here one or maybe two more times this week. But after that, I won't be live for that whole week, 19th. To the 26th, I guess you could say. So sorry about that, guys. I will have a Father's Day article I'm working on. Father's Day is a very this is a difficult period for me because it's a 5th year anniversary of my father's death. He died around this time. He died 2 weeks after the 10th of the 24th, 2017, June 24th. So this is always a tough time for me. So I am going to try to take it a little more easy, but I am going to write an article on that I think you guys will like. And this is a time to be human, to be real, So it's going to be one of those kind of articles. It will have political content for you all who want to get something out of it, but it really will be about Father's Day, fatherhood, imperialism, the machinery of death that I believe, you know, had a huge hand in taking his life prematurely. So you will want to read that. I'll have that on Substack. Thank you, Loa Socialisti. Yes, Friends of Socialist China. That was a great event. You want to definitely check that out, Friends of Socialist China. But with that said, guys, patreon.com/DannyHaiFong if you can. These are tough times. I get it. I know. I'm so close to my goal, so I'm just trying to plug as much as I can. So please do support if you're able. I will see you on Colin. Give me about 2 to 5 minutes, and I'll be there with all of you, okay? But the room is here once again, last time in the chat. We can have a good discussion. Give me 2 to 5 minutes to plug in on my phone and then also get some water. I'm getting a little hoarse. So I'll see you then, all right, guys? Peace out, comrades. Bye-bye.